Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. And I welcome you. Today, we're going to take a look at how where you live can frequently determine not just the quality of your life, but also how long you're going to live. Really interesting new information on that. And also, I've been doing a lot of work on electromagnetic pulses. That's the type of non-ionizing radiation that can really adversely affect your cells, your DNA, your chromosomes, your telomeres. I'm going to have a pro-industry advocate at a conference, private conference, that I got the audio clip from, talk about how dangerous it is. Now, why wasn't this headline news in every major newspaper, where the industry itself admits its shortcomings and the danger of its appliances? These are the cell phones. These are the current rage. So we will. Then I'll also tell you from a study from the Kaiser Permanente Division of Research in California what they found. The study links the health risks to electromagnetic field exposure. We're living in a constant electromagnetic grid. Every school, library, subway station on the streets of New York, every apartment building, every office building now has these grids. So you don't see them. They're invisible, but they're there. They're penetrating your body. Not good. And a lot more on health and healing. Also today, Chris Hedges, a short but very powerful 5-minute commentary called The Great Depression, is the best case. Then a part of a longer series on Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, why they should be broken up. And my guest in the second part of our program is Dr. Terry Allen Coopers. He is a psychiatrist, and he is also on the faculty of the Wright Institute at Berkeley. And we're going to talk about the human rights crisis in American supermax prisons, as well as solitary confinement, and how it matters, and how it's worsening under Trump. And if time permits, leaked documents expose how corporations are using spies to subvert every people's movement in the world. Wow. And tomorrow, I'm going to do a special commentary on the African Enlightenment, how the highest ideals, things I've discussed on this program, like the Age of Enlightenment with Locke and Hume and Kant, were first proposed more than a century earlier than them by an Ethiopian in a cave. So I'll share that with you. And also tomorrow, we have all been under the assumption, the absolute presumption, that America is a thriving democracy. It is not, and never has been. How is that possible? In the commentary I'll share with you tomorrow, a history lesson on why we are not a democracy and never have been. So we have a lot to deal with. And time permitting today, I will open our lines up for some talk back. But let's begin with the latest on health and healing. First off, this is from Kaiser Permanente Division of Research, and they published this in the scientific journal Scientific Reports. And a study of real-world exposure, what we go through every day, to non-ionizing radiation from magnetic fields, and what it did to pregnant women. This is brand new information. It caused higher rates of miscarriage and proving that it's a real and present danger to us. Now, for those of you who may not be aware of the full extent, non-ionizing radiation from magnetic fields is produced when electric devices are in use and electricity is flowing. And it can be generated by a number of environmental sources, including electric appliances and power lines and transformers, wireless devices, and wireless networks. Now, you've seen the ad, I'm sure, where the guy said, I used to work for the other company, and now we are 1% within reach of their, like Verizon. Well, what they're talking about there is that they now have so many towers all over the United States that almost anywhere you go, you can get a signal. Now, if you can get a signal, that's bad. That means the signal can get you. Have you ever been in the Lincoln Tunnel if you live in New York or in any tunnel in America and you turn on your cell phone and you're able to get a signal? That means that it's going in both directions. A signal is coming in and a signal is going out, unless it's on airplane mode. Then it's only one way. That means that your entire body, but specifically your head, your ear, your jaw, your eye, your brain is getting a full push of electromagnetic pulses. And those pulses are damaging. It's not could they. They are. We have irrefutable proof. You can see on MRIs how your brain heats up and how the chromosomes, which are hypersensitive to heat, are overheated, and how then the chromosomes, the telomeres at the end of the chromosomes, the protein caps that keep the chromosomes intact, keep it from unraveling, how, and inside the chromosomes, you also are going to have the mitochondria, and that's your energy factories. That's what keeps your cells functioning. All that's adversely affected. Now, what is the actual safe amount of an electromagnetic pulse that you can have in a week? 120 seconds, 2 minutes, and an entire week. Now imagine how much we're using daily. And that's why this is such an important piece of information. This is what the Dr. Lai, the medical MD, PhD, principal investigator, says, quote, for few studies have been able to accurately measure exposure to magnetic field ionizing, non-ionizing radiation. In addition, due to the current lack of research on this subject, we don't know the biological threshold beyond which problems may develop. And we also don't yet understand the possible mechanisms for increased risk. Well, it's not true. I have over 47 studies on the dangers of just cell phones increasing brain cancer, brain tumors. So if you can cause a miscarriage in a developing fetus, then imagine what it does to your eyes, which are hypersensitive to oxidation and non-ionizing radiation, and the muscles in your heart and the cells in your brain, causing inflammation. And inflammation is the number one cause of disease. Now, free radicals can stimulate inflammation. Chemical imbalances, hormonal imbalances can also do that. Environmental causes are at the top of the list. But it's when your cells are inflamed, then you can get cancer, arthritis, diabetes, dementia, kidney failure, macular degeneration. All that comes from inflammation. So just keep that in mind, from your hair blower to your microwave oven to the radio in your car. All that is bringing in electromagnetic pulses. Minimize it if you can. 175 years on, a study finds where you live still determines your life expectancy. This is from the University of Liverpool. And what they found was they revisited a study carried out 175 years ago, which compared the health and life expectancy of people in different parts of the country. And they say that the findings are still accurate. They found that stark differences still exist, and that people living in Liverpool still had lower life expectancy than those living in rural Rutland. The original study into sanitation conditions in 1842 charted the average age by death and by occupational group by five areas of the United Kingdom: Liverpool, Leeds, Manchester, Bolton, and Rutland, a rural county in eastern England. And the findings revealed a strong correlation between where you lived, what your job was, and the age you lived to. Quote, "This was the first study to demonstrate the huge geographical differences in health and life circumstances. It showed that the laborer in Rutland could expect to live a longer life than a professional tradesman in Liverpool." And so why? And how does that apply to us in Canada, in the United States, and other places? Well, let me give you an example. Most of the time, when you're living within your own generations, meaning your grandparents, your parents, yourself, and the generation of your children, very little changes most of the time. Where you live, your habits, what you do once you are in a trade, once you are in a relationship, once you have a family and you have a home, and your career is in front of you, very little changes. In fact, we get to a point where we get bored with our work or our relationships or ourselves, and we look for things to distract us from our boredom. It might be a hobby. It might be today it's television. There was a time in the 1940s and 50s it was soap operas. And today, for a whole new generation, it's their cell phones. Their portable devices, their smartphones. But little else changes. Most people's diets do not change at all because you're used to certain tastes and smells and mouthfeels, certain levels of fullness. If one of the things you notice when people come to a retreat is that they think they're going to be hungry because they're not going to be eating animal proteins or wheat products. And yet they find that after they've gone through a meal, and they almost always overeat at that first meal, they're not hungry. Because they're used to eating, let's say, something has an animal protein and lots of animal fats, so it creates a longer satiety or staying of our appetite, which is one of the reasons that the Atkins diet was successful. It was only successful in one respect and very unsuccessful in many others. It was successful in that if you ate, let's say, an apple, an hour later, that apple's digested. Good, you're benefiting from it, but now you may be hungry again, in which case you eat something else. But when you ate a piece of meat with a lot of fat in it, you might not be hungry again for another 6 to 7 hours, in which case then the idea was you wouldn't be eating all that incidental food in between your meals, and therefore you'd be losing weight. And that's actually accurate. It's unhealthy. It shortens your lifespan. It speeds up glycation, premature aging of the cells, but you're not as hungry as often. And the more we snack, the more unhealthy the snack is, because you can have healthy snacks, but most people don't. Those empty calories from the multiple snacks are what really nail your weight to a high body mass index, meaning fat. So the idea is that you should understand that when you're not overstressing your body, and when you're eating right and you get an enjoyment from the smell and the taste and anticipation of certain meals, pizzas, or if you're thirsty, a cola, or if it's late at night, some sugary snack, you get used to that. Now move to an area where everything is different. Move into a relationship where the other person doesn't subscribe to that kind of diet and wants you to change to a healthier diet. Move to an area where your hours of work change, where you're now having to work longer hours or into an evening, and everything in your biology changes. And that can speed up your aging process. Let me give you three examples. Police officers and firefighters and medics and people working in hospitals, people working in television radio stations at night, if you work more than 10 years, you've knocked about anywhere from 7 to 10 years off your life expectancy. People who work around electromagnetic pulses, let's say you worked in a radio station, you're around an awful lot of electromagnetic pulses. That can knock years off your life. And if you work, let's say, at any of the television broadcasting stations, you'll see big, they're huge. They're dish antennas outside. That's beaming out a satellite beam. That's also creating a massive electromagnetic pulse all through the facility. Let's say you're looking at monitors, like you're a security guard at night, and you got 15 monitors, 20 monitors, 50 monitors in front of you. Every one of those is throwing an electromagnetic pulse into your body. That is shortening your life. Now add in the third component, and that is stress. Because when we're not getting a good night's sleep, and most people work nocturnal hours don't, then that knocks years off your life. So if you take just those three things alone, and if the average lifespan should be around 78 to 80, you're now at your death date, if nothing else changes, if you're the average person, not doing anything exceptional, at around 60, 55 to 65, you're already at your death date. So when you die of a heart attack or stroke, people say, wow, they were young. What could have possibly caused that? I don't know. Yes, we do know if we put all the pieces together, and that's why where you live and what work you do where you live and the quality of your relationship and the quality of your diet is very important. There are places in America where the food is just terrible. Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, most of Florida, Kentucky and Tennessee, all those states, garbage diets. Now, I've lived in three states in that area, Texas, Florida, and West Virginia. Terrible diets. In fact, I went so far as to look at all the national statistics on diseases. Obesity, they're number one. Malnutrition, number one. Being overfed and undernourished, number one. Eating junk food, number one. Fried food, number one. And then heart disease and stroke and diabetes, number one. Now, that doesn't mean everyone in the states and all the food is bad. It's not, unless you're the average person, in which case you're conditioned to stay within boundaries. So when they're saying that where you live makes a difference, it does. If you live near a seaport, let's say you live in Seattle or up in Portland or different cities on the ocean in Northern California, or if you live in Boston or Massachusetts or Rhode Island, then the likelihood is you're going to have a higher proportion of your diet being seafood, fresh seafood. And you'll also have more vegetables, in which case then you're going to have a healthier diet and live longer. If you're around an orchard, you're going to be eating more fruit. But if you're living in an area like West Virginia, where I grew up, where there were no fresh vegetables or fruits, in the summertime, if you had a local victory garden, what's called a V garden, and you grew something, good. But the rest of the year, everything was canned, and if it was canned, it was high in salt or high in sugar. All the fruits that we got in the wintertime, like pears, peaches, loaded with sugar. And no enzymes because it had been boiled out during the pasteurization, during the canning process. So it does make a difference where you live. And what's nice is that an awful lot of millennials are working with some of the baby boomer and senior generation in supporting farmers markets and local farming, and they're opening up restaurants where there's locally grown produce, lots of salads. I just passed one last night up on Broadway. That it was a whole salad bar in there. And I looked at the menu. It had a lot of healthy salads. But that's something new. They're looking at, in England, the English people have one of the worst diets in the world and one of the shortest life expectancies, unless they choose to be healthy. And finally, it says from Kaiser, again, postmenopausal women, and that's a lot of, we're talking about tens of millions of American women are postmenopausal now, should still steer clear of hormone replacement therapy. Quote, yet again, the nation's leading authority on preventative medicine says postmenopausal women should avoid hormone replacement therapy. The U.S. Preventative Service Task Force is standing by its original recommendation that women who have already gone through menopause should avoid use of female hormones to guard against osteoporosis and diabetes, said the task force chairman. Quote, basically, the task force concluded there was no overall benefit from taking hormones to prevent chronic conditions. All right. I'm glad to hear that. But here's what they didn't tell you. It's not that you don't get the benefit. Here's what you will likely get. At least 13% minimally will get. Breast cancer, ovarian cancer, heart attacks, strokes, dementia, and colorectal cancer. Those are the side effects of taking synthetic hormone replacement therapy. Now, in a study, which you can read, it's been published up on my website, along with 740 studies I've published in my lifetime. And this was a peer review study. It took a year to do. We started with over 400 women. I think we ended up with around 288. But we met on a regular basis for 1 year. And we actually had 8 of the women who were postmenopause, the oldest was 8 years postmenopause, became premenopause. Everything changed. Their hair from being dry and thinning, their eyebrows from thinning became thick, lusterful, and new hair at its natural color grew back in. The skin tightened up again. Bags and sags and crevices and crow's feet and 11 lines all diminished or gone. Hot flashes, night sweats, gone. Osteoporosis, gone. Thinning of the bones, gone. Arthritis in the joints, gone. Fibromyalgia, gone. All forms of depression and weight gain, gone. Hormone balance back to normal. Thyroid back to normal. Metabolism back to normal. Libido back to normal. The thinning, dry chafing of the vagina that caused painful and irritation with normal sexual relationship back to being normal and naturally lubricated. The skin in particular, fingernails and toenails that were ridged and cracked and flecked and fungus were now pink and hard. And so in effect, we reversed their aging process, all without any medications, all with exercise, plant-based diet, the use of a lot of herbs like a butcher's broom and dong quai, pho thai, passion flower, Vitex, squall vine, and blue cohosh, and lots of nutrients and lots of juices. But we did it. It worked. And we did it under scientific conditions, and it was published, and I presented that before a group of scientists, thousands of scientists, in fact. So they're telling you not to take it, and I commend them for that. That's good news, because we could be sacrificing about 1.3 million women every single year on the altar of medical hubris, indifference, and ignorance. Because what they didn't say is what you will get if you do take those. Let me put it a different way. If you haven't watched the film The Deer Hunter, there's an interesting scene at the end where Christopher Walken has nothing to live for. He's doped out. He's in a Saigon bar. He's playing Russian roulette. When you take synthetic hormone replacement therapy, you're playing biological Russian roulette. It's just a matter of time. If you don't get it this year, maybe the next year. My mother died of a massive heart attack in the middle of the night. She was only 58 years of age. Her doctor recommended synthetic hormone replacement therapy a year before. I tried to talk her out of it. I tried to talk the doctor out of it. But I've never had any success with any member of my family when it came to making healthier choices than ones they would. So I'm particularly concerned and incensed about any woman taking synthetic hormone replacement therapy because your doctor told you it will help you overcome hot flashes or prevent osteoporosis. There are a lot of ways to prevent both without putting your life in jeopardy. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Oh, by the way, before we go to the break, I thought you'd find this interesting. This is the University of California. Remember, I was telling you the grapes are one of nature's 10 most perfect foods, and I make sure I take grapes every day. If I can eat them, great. I like eating grapes. But if I can't, I just take a concentrate. If I have some grape concentrate, I'll take it, or otherwise I'll take a grape powder, which is the most concentrated of all. Here's the latest study. Just found this morning. This is from University of California at Los Angeles, and it was published in Experimental Gerontology, and, quote, dementia risk reduced by eating grapes. I repeat, dementia risk reduced by eating grapes. So they finally caught up. So think of how many people in this audience already are bringing grapes into your body every day, 7 days a week. And now if you are aware that she is, my memory's improving. My cognition's improving. Wonder why? Now you know. And currently there are over 5 million Americans suffering from Alzheimer's. And that's the most common form of dementia. But to make matters worse, this disease is projected to reach epidemic proportions because of my generation. You know, we were, until the millennials, the largest generation in American history. Now they are. But it means that there are at least 70 million of us who are at that age in life where we are susceptible to what we thought we would never find, and that is our body aging. Well, and it is. But it doesn't have to be a detriment. You can actually, with the knowledge we have today, you can de-age. We are doing it all the time, every day. Those of us, that's my specialty. That's what I spent 33 years as a research fellow and scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology, anti-aging medicine. Yes, I did psi research. I did energy research. But I was known for my 164 separate major studies on anti-aging. So here we have something. A single item. This was just published this week. Quote, in a just published study from UCLA, researchers found that grapes can have significant effects on preventing cognitive decline and to help prevent the development of Alzheimer's disease. Wow. And we know why. I mean, we know what's in the grape. We know the proanthocyanidins. And we know that the brain can be rejuvenated. We know that all the old science on the brain is just out of date. So good for us, good for you, for making sure you get grapes every day in your diet. We're 29 minutes into our program, almost halfway through. We're going to take a break, and we're coming right out of the break into The Great Depression is the Best Case by Chris Hedges. Please stay with us, and you can watch this program on Facebook tonight. And we're just collecting our numbers of how many of you have come in to the Progressive Radio Network to listen to my show in the last 12 months, and I'll have those numbers for you shortly.
modern paradigm was created by those men and women who are now long gone. Their sacrifice and dedication made it possible for the United States to become the world's lone superpower. Almost 40% of the economy had something to do with agriculture back then. Now it is less than 3%. Back then, people could farm on their own gardens, raise their own livestock, and take care of themselves. Now we rely upon corporate food, and the food that we get has no nutritional value. Back then, people knew what real wealth was. They had gold and silver in their money. Now we think the digits in our brokerage account is wealth. Back then, people had a strong family and community support systems to help them. Multi-generational housing was very common. Now we live little lives of narcissism. Our families have been split up and divided and conquered. Back then, people had strong spiritual strength. Now we have chemically induced denial. Back then, people were of fit body and strong mind. Now we're obese and willingly ignorant. Back then, people had a classical education to help them figure things out. Now we have to wait for answers. Back then, people had a real economy. Now all we have is a consumer debt economy. Back then, people did physical activity for fun. Now we have entertainment that turns our minds and our bodies into mush. Let's take a few seconds to look at some of the faces of the Great Depression. Look at the faces of these people and ask yourself, do you think that if given a chance to do something different than the path they chose before the Great Depression, they would? Do you think that these people were aware and prepared for a collapse? Do you think that they had the mental or physical assets in place to deal with this new paradigm? Do you think that you are better than these Americans? If you think it's hard to hear your child cry when they don't get their way, wait until they can't get food. If you think it's hard to get a job in this economy, wait until there is no economy. Can you imagine strapping all your family's wealth into a car and then traveling across country with the hopes of actually finding a job? Right now, the average American is actually worth less than a Bangladeshi peasant. The reason why is because that peasant does not have trillions of dollars worth of debt tied around their necks. They may be poor, but they're not in debt. The very real world coming takes a lot of effort and patience to succeed, and that is something that our society is in short supply of. While tent cities are popping up here and there, the real crippling of poverty is just getting started. The generation that made it through the Great Depression would often say, "We didn't have much, but we had each other." This stands in stark contrast to today, where we have so much, but no one to share it with. We can survive anything together, but when the average American family has been divided and conquered, we have very little hope. The generational support system has been ripped from our human experience, and it is a key of getting back on our feet. Emotionally tough people can make it through anything. They can move on and adapt. But emotionally weak people break because they've never been challenged. Those that have been bred to thrive in a collectivist paradigm, to do as they're told and not ask questions, will be left destitute when there is no one to tell them what to do as the paradigm collapses. Only those with the power of critical thinking will be able to adapt to this new reality. Physical poverty is one thing, but mental poverty is quite another. Everything you know is probably dependent upon this paradigm. Ask yourself this question: what real value do you have to a post-dollar collapse environment? How many men sacrificed time with those that mattered, chasing after an illusion that failed them the moment they reached for it? Think about all those things that we work so hard for, and how quickly they can become worthless when the paradigm collapses. McMansions and Ponzi scheme retirements are the real dream, while now the only dream that they have is about the real relationships and opportunities long gone. Men will be split from their families as they seek opportunities far and wide, and women will have to endure not only their world falling apart, but trying desperately to shield their children from a harsh new reality. How many mothers do you think are going to sit and regret that they did not prepare themselves or their children for a collapse? How many wish that they had not wasted their time and energy and money chasing after things that mean nothing? After all, how important is fashion, soap opera, and reality TV? Perhaps the most famous picture of the Great Depression was of Florence Owens Thompson, taken by Dorothea Lange. Dorothea Lange wrote in her notes from the 10-minute photo shoot, "Seven hungry children, the father is a native Californian, destitute in pea pickers' camp because of their failure of early pea crop. These people had just sold their tires to buy food. I did not ask her name or her history. She had told me her age and that she was 32 years old. She said that they'd been living on frozen vegetables from the surrounding fields and the birds the children killed.
Great Depression. That was not Chris Hedges. We do have Chris Hedges. I have a whole series of audio clips, and to think that for a moment, just I wanted you to hear that, and if you were able to watch it, I wanted you to watch it, but you'll be able to do that on Facebook later when this show's posted later in the day. We're taking so much for granted today, and when I travel, as I do all the time, and had to for a number of years, 7 years it took to produce and write and direct and film Poverty, Inc., and if you have time today or tonight, please watch Poverty, Inc., because those are the people who are replaying what many Americans went through during the Great Depression. They don't have any food. They might have to wait all day to get one meal at a soup kitchen someplace. And I went to one of those soup kitchens. It was down in Florida. I live in the Southwest Florida. This was on the East, Northeast Florida. And I watched as hundreds of individuals walk silently for miles to get to a soup kitchen called the Daily Bread up near Titusville, which is near Cape Canaveral. And they would go in, and whatever the gentleman who ran the soup kitchen could do, he would provide food. And he also had a woman's shower and a men's shower, so at least people who needed to take a shower could. And he also had some clothes that he had picked up that they could, if they didn't have any clothes to wear, other than what they had on, they could get some free clothing. The state didn't support him. The federal government didn't support him. And the local community didn't support him. In fact, the local community didn't like the fact he was there because homeless people would walk through their neighborhoods to get there. There was no crime. These people didn't commit any crime. They were just poor. And as when I went in there, and I went in several times, and I now support them, by the way. In fact, I'll be sending a tractor trailer of organic food down, as I do in January, to them to help them. I talk with people. Where'd you come from? And I actually spoke with adjunct professors, people of all walks of life, and they never thought it would happen to them. They never thought that they would be destitute, homeless. So I was just amazed at the variety of backgrounds people had and still trying to find some reason to live. And suicide levels were high, especially among homeless vets, and most of the homeless vets also came there. But then I followed them when they left there, when they had their one meal of the day, and that's all they would eat. They had no television, no radio, most had no cell phones. And a lot of them lived in the woods, not in tents. They just lived in the woods. They might have had a sleeping bag. Now, mind you, you're in Florida. You know what also lives in the woods? Coral snakes and panthers, bobcats, coyotes, bears and alligators. Yeah, that also lives there. So imagine that is what you face each day, and never a word of that suffering. Not a word in the media, any media. So I just want to remind people, we shouldn't just be focusing upon the newest gentrified neighborhood and the latest bar that people are being charged of $60 for a glass of locally brewed beer and $85 for a boar's head sandwich, that we're taking so much for granted. And I'm just asking us to stop for a moment and understand there are a whole lot of people who are not invited to the table. And that's on us. Now, we have the Chris Hedges, and this is what I believe Chris has nailed that we should also pay attention to. Please listen to Chris Hedges.
The decline of American empire began long before the current economic meltdown or the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. It began before the first Gulf War or Ronald Reagan. It began when we shifted, in the words of the Harvard historian Charles Mayer, from an empire of production to an empire of consumption. By the end of the Vietnam War, when the costs of the war ate away at Lyndon Johnson's great society, and domestic oil production began its steady, inexorable decline, we saw our country transformed from one that primarily produced to one that primarily consumed. We started borrowing to maintain a lifestyle as well as an empire we could no longer afford. We began to use force, especially in the Middle East, to feed our insatiable thirst for cheap oil. And the bill is now due. America's most dangerous enemies are not Islamic radicals, but those who sold us the perverted ideology of free market capitalism and globalization. They have dynamited the foundations of our society. In the 17th century, these speculators would have been hung. Today, they run the government and consume billions in taxpayer subsidies. These corporate forces will never permit real reform. It would mean their extinction. The oil and gas industry will never allow us to achieve energy independence. That would devastate their profits. Real reform would wipe out tens of billions of dollars in weapons contracts. It would cripple the financial health of a host of private contractors, from Lockheed Martin to Boeing to Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, Halliburton, Blackwater, now renamed Z. And it would render obsolete the existence of the U.S. Central Command. It was Bill Clinton who led the Democratic Party to the corporate watering trough. Clinton argued that the party could ditch labor unions, no longer a source of votes or power, as a political ally. Workers, he insisted, would vote Democratic anyway. They had no choice. It was better, he argued, to take corporate money and do corporate bidding. By the 1990s, the Democratic Party, under Clinton's leadership, had virtual fundraising parity with the Republicans. Today, the Democrats get more. The legislation demanded by corporations, including the North American Free Trade Agreement, thrust a knife into the back of the American working class. NAFTA was peddled by the Clinton White House as an opportunity to raise incomes and prosperity of the citizens of the United States, Canada, and Mexico. NAFTA would also, we were told, staunch Mexican immigration into the United States. But NAFTA, which took effect in 1994, reversed every one of Clinton's rosy predictions. Once the Mexican government lifted price supports on corn and beans grown by Mexican farmers, those farmers had to compete against the huge agribusinesses in the United States. Many Mexican farmers were swiftly bankrupt. At least 2 million Mexican farmers have been driven off their land since 1994. And guess where many of them went? This desperate flight of poor Mexicans into the United States is now being exacerbated by large-scale factory closures along the border as manufacturers pack up and leave Mexico for China. But we were assured that goods would be cheaper, workers would be wealthier, everyone would be happier. I am not sure how these contradictory things were supposed to happen, but in a soundbite society, reality no longer matters.
Chris Hedges. I'll be playing several short clips of Chris dealing with different aspects of American economy and our mindset and our body politics on upcoming programs. In a moment, we're going to go by Skype to California to interview our guest on the crisis, the human rights crisis in American supermax prisons and solitary confinement, and how Trump is making it all so much worse. I just want to mention, however, that next Thursday at 7 o'clock, I'll be having a private, limited premiere showing of my newest documentary. The documentary is entitled Deadly Deception, and boy, does it expose corruption. Names, names, shows you their faces, gives you their background, and well, I won't go into any more than that. It's probably the most powerful, hard-hitting documentary And I've done a lot of powerful, hard-hitting documentaries. One documentary alone, Fatal Fallout, or no, not Fatal Fallout, it was The War on Health. When you would Google it for search results, it was for over 3 years, number one in the world, with hundreds of millions of search results. So people are paying attention. And oh, by the way, I was just told that just on YouTube from our documentaries, 6 million views this year. So I put the documentaries up there for free so people can download them and watch and share them, because these are part of a social movement to educate people on the issues, show them the truth, and hopefully they will take it forward from there. So this is the newest one. And this is called Deadly Deception. I will be there. We'll have a discussion afterwards. You'll get a copy. Not only will you see the film, but you'll also get a copy of it afterwards. Here is the number you call. If you have any trouble getting the number, you can also go online, symphonyspace.org, symphonyspace.org. The phone number is 212-864-5400, 212-864-5400, and it is a small showing. The larger showing, which I'll do as a fundraiser for our sister station WBAI in a large theater, will be in the spring, because I've got a full sketch between now and then. So I hope that those of you who appreciate the films, the documentaries on social issues that I produce and write and direct, that you will be there. Yeah, this is a real eye-opener. This has not been done before. This is a real original called Deadly Deception. Again, the phone number for reservations, which will be on the Upper West Side, 212-864-5400, 212-864-5400. Now let's go out and say hello to our guest who is standing by, Dr. Terry Allen Coopers, and he is a psychiatrist. He serves on the faculty at the Wright Institute in Berkeley, California, a graduate academy founded by the pioneering psychiatrist Nevitt Sanford that offers higher degrees in clinical psychology. He specializes in psychoanalysis and forensics and community psychiatric integration. And he is also regarded as one of the foremost authorities on the adverse effects of solitary confinement. And for 40 years, he's been evaluating correctional and prison institutions, and he has provided testimony for prisoner rights in class action litigation. He is also he is a graduate of Stanford University and received his medical degree from UCLA. His most recent book is Solitary, The Inside Supermax Isolation, and How We Can Abolish It, published by University of California Press. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Good to be with you.
I believe the average person knows very little about the extent of solitary confinement in American prison systems. And the image we are given by Hollywood movies is that of a prisoner does something wrong during his or her incarceration and is then punished for a short period of time in a tiny isolated cell. But the problem is far more severe, and there are approximately 100,000 prisoners now locked away in solitary conditions. With the privatization of prisons and now with a little federal oversight, prisons can do literally what they wish, including cost-cutting by providing horrible food, massive overcrowding, minimal amenities, hygiene needs, and medical and mental health services are almost non-existent. And since staff salaries are poor, they are staffed by people, many of whom have low qualifications. And it is as if our prisons have become similar to the old French penal colonies for permanent exile, such as Devil's Island in French Guiana during the 19th century, and which remained operative until the 1950s. So the best place to begin is to have you summarize for us the extent of solitary confinement in our prisons and how many inmates are held in confinement, and what is the average length of time, and what are the conditions like, and what is the ultimate purpose or mission for even continuing with this form of inhumane punishment in correctional facilities? The form is yours.
Well, there are well over 100,000 prisoners in solitary confinement today. That number doesn't include, for instance, prisoners in jails who spend, they're not called solitary confinement, but they spend all their time in a jail cell because there's nothing to do in the jail. Solitary confinement burst on the scene in the 1980s when the prisons were totally out of control. There had been massive overcrowding. The prison population had risen by 4 or 7 times since the 70s, a lot because of the war on drugs. The crowded prisons could not supply meaningful programs to the prisoners. They were just oversubscribed, and the prisoners got in a lot of trouble. We know that crowding causes violence and an increase in psychiatric breakdown and suicide. At the time, I was among a number of experts who said what you need to do is downsize the prisons. For instance, stop putting people at low-level drug offenders in prison, and then the staff can provide programs for the other prisoners. That's the other thing that was needed. The rehabilitation was being cut down, and they actually needed to enlarge the rehabilitation programs so that people in prison would have skills for when they're released, they could succeed in the community. Instead, the powers that be made a foolhardy decision, and they turned to solitary confinement. They said they were locking up the worst of the worst, which is actually not correct at all. And I call it a historic wrong turn. They started putting more and more people in solitary confinement. They built entire prisons or cell blocks that were dedicated to solitary confinement, where the prisoners stay in a little cell with a toilet and a sink and a bunk bed almost 24 hours a day. In many places, it's literally 24 hours a day. This causes massive psychological damage, anxiety, paranoia, memory problems, despair. Suicide is sky high. And then even worse, people who have mental illness, and probably over 50% of prisoners are suffering from some significant mental illness, their mental illness is exacerbated and becomes worse, and their prognosis becomes much worse, so that the whole population that spends time in solitary comes out of prison with what I call the decimation of life skills. They've forgotten how to relate to people. They are unable to do productive tasks, and they're just damaged as people. Some people spend a short time in solitary. In the old days, it was called the hole, and people spend 10 days or a month there. But today, I've met people in California. We just won a lawsuit, the Asker versus Brown lawsuit at Pelican Bay State Prison, where a lot of the prisoners in the SHU, which is the acronym for supermax isolation, had been there for decades, many for 40 years, sitting in a cell by themselves.
You've said that our prisons are the sites for the worst human rights abuses. I would imagine most of this abuse is common in supermaximum prisons. A couple decades ago, there were few supermaximum prisons. Now their numbers have increased dramatically. Why this growth in supermax, and how does supermax prisons differ from average facilities of incarceration?
Well, when we say lock them up and throw away the key, the society just doesn't care. These are people who are disappeared, and not accidentally. A lot of people suffer from special problems, for instance, mental illness. And society goes on sort of ignoring what happens. One of the things that happens in a place where we consign people and then we stop paying attention is that massive abuses mount. That is, the officers abuse the prisoners and nobody knows about it. It happens in secret. That's been going on. The authorities in corrections say that they need solitary confinement to discipline and manage the prisons so that they'll operate smoothly. And what they're talking about is you put someone in a cell, often with a solid metal door, so they have no visual contact with anyone. They have no one to talk to. There's no window on the outside. And basically, they fall apart in that cell. But the prison is running smoothly. They pass a food tray in and they get the empty tray back and they say everything's fine. And that's when these people are damaged. They say they need it for control, but the director of the Colorado Department of Corrections, Rick Ramish, just wrote an op-ed in the New York Times announcing that they had gotten rid of solitary confinement in the Colorado prisons. There is not an increase in violence when they get rid of solitary. I was part of a lawsuit in Mississippi where the same thing happened. We closed the Supermax unit because of all the massive human rights abuses inside. And one would expect, if it's true that solitary helps with the violence and discipline problem, one would expect a spike in violence. Instead, what we found is when we closed the solitary confinement Supermax unit, the violence throughout the entire prison system was reduced, very strongly reduced, and the disciplinary tickets were reduced. So actually, it's wrong to say that it helps the authorities run their prisons.
It is evident that the war on drugs and later prison privatization has contributed more to our incarceration tragedy than anything else. And Hillary and Bill Clinton's three strikes and you're out, it didn't help matters either. Near the end of his term, I recall Obama wanted to regulate solitary confinement more and reduce its use. He also wanted to improve prison conditions but never got around to it. If I was President Obama, he had a historic moment. He could have freed every single nonviolent drug offender in American prisons. He chose not to. That was a choice. And I just think that the politicalization of this war on drugs by every single president, everyone who wants to run for electus, is a mistake. And I believe if we emptied out our prisons of those of nonviolent drug offenses, we would see a completely different prison system and conditions in it. Your final thoughts, please.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. Unfortunately, the federal government, or fortunate at the moment, the federal government only runs about 200,000 of the beds in prison, of the 2.5 million people who are in jail and prison. Only 200,000 are under federal control. President Obama did feel that solitary was a human rights abuse and should be ended, and also that private prison contractors tend to hire fewer people at lower salaries with less training than the public sector, and therefore there are more abuses in the private prisons than in the state-run and county-run prisons. So he was on the path to reform sentencing so fewer people would be in prison, to end solitary confinement, and to not contract with private corporations to run the prisons. Unfortunately, President Trump has the opposite, and Attorney General Sessions, they have the opposite view on all of those points. I mean, President Trump is in favor of waterboarding. So they are trying to increase the solitary confinement and to increase contracts with the private prison corporations. The private prison corporation's stock went up to record numbers after Trump was elected. And they're increasing the length of sentences rather than decreasing them. This is counter to the entire reform movement that had been going on for two decades. And we see the real traumatic torture going on in the immigration detention facilities, which are under the president's control. So what's happening is we're getting a spike in abuses at the immigration centers, which tend to be private corporations and tend to use a lot of solitary confinement.
Well, I'm sure if this president could, he would bring back the guillotine or stoning. It is just watching a reptilian-brained person run our country is beyond belief. Terry Allen, thank you for writing the very good book that you did. It will educate people. I highly recommend people read the book and educate yourself on what the problem is about solitary confinement. All the best to you.
Thank you very much. And I just want to mention the racism in it all. Practically 50% of prisoners are African American, and if you go in a solitary confinement unit, you see an even greater disproportion. So the racism just gets reflected and multiplied in the prisons.
You're absolutely correct. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day. Your touch alone.
so slowly, and time can do so much.